I know it's a new year and all, but so far there is a whole lot of economic same old going on out there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 2nd of January. Good to have you along on this first business day of the year, everybody. And to that end, in fact, a couple of reminders here about the macroeconomic state of play as we get back going after the holidays. First of all, volatility. It is still here with a vengeance. The Dow Industrials swung through a 500-point range today before finishing basically where it started. Number two and three are kind of a pair. Item two, the global economy, is still, well, soft is a good word. Item number three, the U.S.-China trade war and its discontent. I put those in that order because when you roll them together, you get this data out of Beijing today that the Chinese manufacturing sector is actually contracting. New orders have fallen for the first time in 2.5 years. There's lots going on in the Chinese economy, of course, but given that country's big and growing place in the global economy, it is worth asking whether the people running China's managed economy can manage their way out of this one. Marketplace's Scott Tong, once upon a time, our former bureau chief in Shanghai, looked into it.
Economists in China say the manufacturing shrinkage there is due to slow orders domestically and overseas. The trade war, which began in July with U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods, has Americans buying less from mainland China and more from other countries like Vietnam. So says supply chain manager Rosemary Coates at Blue Silk Consulting.
In the past 20 years, I've never seen a slowdown like this. I don't think there's been any kind of mass exodus like we're seeing now.
Factory blues are contributing to a broader economic funk in China. Growth has slowed from 9% to 6% or so the past decade. At times like this, Beijing often intervenes in what some call its state capitalism model. How? Yasheng Huang teaches business at MIT.
There's no secret to it. It's basically debt. D-E-B-T. The government has this massive ability to mobilize debt capital to support pet projects.
As in highways, airports, condos, Chinese policymakers could do that again this time, but to Huang, that's a short-term sugar high. Consultant Daniel Rosen at the Rhodium Group says a government-heavy model worked when China was poor. Now it's middle income.
It's no longer suitable to have government come along with a big infrastructure investment plan and expect that that's going to carry things through. It's on the backs of nearly 1.4 billion Chinese now.
In other words, China needs consumers to drive its economy rather than government planning. But that transformation will take time. And for now, Chinese factories waiting for that are struggling. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Here's item number four in the things to keep your eye on list for 2019, the dollar. The greenback did pretty well against most other major currencies last year, but a lot of foreign exchange analysts are predicting a weaker dollar is on the way. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains why the dollar might weaken and what that might mean for American companies and consumers.
Before we forget our old acquaintance 2018, a quick look back. U.S. economic growth was strong. Investors knew the Federal Reserve would continue raising interest rates, widening the gap between interest rates in the U.S. and the rest of the world. Scott Wren is an equity strategist at the Wells Fargo Investment Institute. He says in 2019,
the Fed's going to be not doing much more in terms of rate hikes while the rest of the world hasn't really started yet. You know, those higher rates, money tends to flow to a higher rate type of an environment.
As Wren says, it's like that hockey metaphor. Investors want to go where the puck is heading, not where it is now, which means the U.S. dollar will not so much sink, but drift lower in 2019. Not everyone agrees. Steve Henke is a professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins. He thinks the dollar will hold steady, maybe even climb. And that's because
it's a relative game when you look at exchange rates. And relative to Europe, the United States will look strong.
Relative to other countries, too, like China. Brian Nick, investment strategist at Nuveen, says the strong dollar has been good for U.S. consumers who buy things with their dollars.
On the flip side, if you're a business and you're trying to sell overseas, a stronger dollar is not your friend because when you're counting those profits back into dollars from whatever currency you earn them in, they're worth less to you.
So those companies will benefit from a slightly weaker U.S. dollar. Nick says, on net, so will the global economy. A weaker dollar also benefits foreign countries and companies that have borrowed in dollars. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
I promise we didn't plan it this way. Oh, that we had. But after the close on Wall Street this afternoon, Apple announced it's cutting its earnings forecast for its most recent quarter, the one that ended in December. And here is why I'm telling you this. First of all, in line with Tracy's story about the strong dollar, Apple said this. We knew the strong dollar would create foreign exchange headwinds and forecasted this would reduce our revenue growth. End of quote, which it has. Also, to Scott's story about China and its slowdown, Apple said this. Most of our revenue shortfall to our guidance and over 100% of our year-over-year worldwide revenue decline occurred in Greater China across iPhone, Mac, and iPad. End of quote. It's kind of wild, right? We tell you about stuff, and there it is, happening in real life. On Wall Street today, as I said, my favorite five-syllable word, volatility. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lest you thought we'd forgotten, there is item number 5 on the economic watch list for this year, and it's spelled Brexit. Prime Minister Theresa May has until January the 14th to convince Parliament it should approve the deal she made to take her country out of the European Union. The problem for Ms. May is that most of Parliament hates that deal. But she does have a not-so-secret weapon, which is that if Parliament doesn't approve her plan, the default position is that Britain might leave the EU come the end of March without any deal at all. And as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, that is unsettling a whole lot of Brits.
Your attention, please. This is a call for all passengers traveling.
The port of Dover on the southeast coast of Britain. 10,000 trucks a day pass through here to and from continental Europe. Without a trade deal by March the 29th, most of this traffic would have to be checked. A nightmare, says John James, who runs the port's largest freight handling company, Star Cargo.
Having a no-deal Brexit and stopping on the 29th would be Armageddon for us here.
Opponents of Brexit have long warned of gridlock at the ports with massive delays, and Brexiteers have long dismissed that as Project Fear.
It's not Project Fear, it will become reality, and that frightens all of us.
Including the UK government. It's put more than 3,000 troops on standby to ensure the free flow of food and drugs from continental Europe in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Health Secretary Matt Hancock told the BBC he's ordered the stockpiling of 6 weeks' supply of medicines.
I've become the largest buyer of fridges in the world. I didn't expect that, but we are buying and building refrigeration capacity to make sure that we have enough for medicines.
It's only prudent, he says, to prepare now for a no-deal scenario.
Because it might happen, not because I want it to happen.
The government is spending $2.5 billion in case of a no-deal outcome, recruiting more border staff, installing more customs software. But British exporters are aghast. Farmers have joined the chorus of disapproval. Without a deal, livestock producers face tariffs of up to 30% on their exports to continental Europe. Minette Batters of the National Union of Farmers.
For British farmers, it is a complete catastrophe to leave the EU with no deal.
And amid chaotic scenes in Parliament, the same message from the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn.
No deal would be a disaster for our country, yeah. And no responsible government would ever allow it.
Most lawmakers agree, but hardline Brexiteers do not. John Longworth of Leave Means Leave says the UK government should have prepared for no deal at the outset, a basic rule of all business negotiation.
No business person would ever go into a negotiation without being prepared to walk away from the table.
And he says walking away is a credible threat when the EU sells much more to Britain than it buys.
The UK doesn't need the European Union half as much as the EU needs the UK.
750,000 German jobs, for example, depend on exports to Britain. Longworth's message to the Brits, hold your nerve, leave the EU without a deal, and then...
We should offer the European Union a free trade arrangement if they wish to take it.
But Britain's five main business organisations dismiss that lack of concern as foolhardy. Fear of crashing out of the EU without a deal is now the dominant emotion here. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
lot of you have probably been thinking about charitable donations the past couple of weeks. Yes, of course, because of the holidays, but also, cynicism aside, to try to do some tax planning. It's going to be a bit before we've got the data on giving during 2018. But in 2017, and this data is according to Giving USA, charitable donations in this country topped $410 billion. A lot of that is people giving just to give. Some of it, though, is people giving because they were asked. Today's installment of our series, My Economy, about how people live in their economic day-to-day, comes from somebody who has money and convinces other people to give money.
I'm Iris Brilliant, and I live in Berkeley, California, and I'm a money coach. The way that this began was I inherited wealth when I turned 22 and graduated from college. My mom's uncle managed to amass some wealth. He never had kids. He invested his money in a classic portfolio, which is, you know, when I inherited it, it was invested in tobacco and weaponry and oil and, you know, all these things that I'd been working so hard against in college. The first thing I did was immediately divest it from oil and tobacco and weaponry and all that stuff. And I started to talk about it one-on-one with my closest friends and really made a lot of mistakes, you know, trying to complain about the burden of having access to wealth to friends. Drowning in debt does not go well. I don't recommend doing that. That was really what inspired me to find other young people with wealth who could relate to my situation. So I got involved in an organization called Resource Generation. It was a space where we could process anything from conflicts to the very nitty-gritty details of our lives. And it was really an anchor for me in my sanity. I found that I had a specific skill and joy in asking our members to really step up their giving by huge amounts. The first place I often start is pushing people to make the decision to not get richer every year, which means giving away roughly 7% of your assets if it's invested in the stock market. I have 6 private clients right now. I want to maintain a hand in the institutionalized philanthropy or wealth management world, but my main joy and my main love is coaching. Money is really sticky, and it sticks to all aspects of our lives. For those of us who have always had access to wealth, I think many of us are scared of who will I be if I don't have money? Will people love me? Will I be safe? Will I find meaning? And we have to be willing to kind of jump off of that cliff together.
Speaking of jumping off cliffs together, we cannot do this series without your help. And, you know, hey, since it's a new year, tell us about how things went for you in 2018 and when your plans for 2019. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, how much we are not going to know about what the government's doing with our money thanks to the shutdown. Economic reports that aren't going to happen this week because, well, you know why. Coming up.
Yeah, you can see we've got a variety of things here. There may be some nudity and profanity.
Wait, whoa, whoa, wait, what? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 18 points today, less than a 10%, closed to 23,346, down almost 400 at one point, the blue chips were. NASDAQ added 30 points, 0.4%, 66.65. S&P 500 found 3 points, looking in the couch cushions, 0.1%, 25.10 there. Tesla off 6.8% today, delivered fewer electric cars in the fourth quarter than everybody expected, and it's cutting prices by $2,000 to help counter a gradual phase out of some federal electric tax credits for electric vehicles, I should say. Consumers are going to be paying more for hundreds of prescription drugs in this new year. More than 36 drug makers are hiking prices. Wall Street Journal reports Allergan is setting the pace with increases of nearly 10%. Allergan up 1.6% today. Apple, by the way, since you asked, down 7% after hours. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The city of New York first started counting traffic fatalities back in 1910. And in all the 108 years since, last year, that is 2018, had the fewest people killed in traffic accidents, a full 10% lower than the total from 2017. Now, yes, it is still 200 people who died, but it's progress. Marketplace's Erica Barris explains what the city has done to bring traffic deaths down and what has yet to be done.
Vision Zero is a program to reduce traffic fatalities that's been successful in Sweden and elsewhere. 5 years ago, New York City decided to spend $1.6 billion on its own version. The key components of the program? Lowering the speed limit to 25 miles an hour on most city streets, which...
It seems like a very simple principle, but it is revolutionary.
That's Ruth Oldenziel, a researcher in the Netherlands. The city has done other things, too, says John Corlett. He's on New York City's Traffic Safety Board. Things like implementing
photo radar in school zones in New York.
And adding more traffic enforcement, getting rid of car lanes, and increasing bicycle infrastructure. But the news wasn't so good for one kind of traffic on New York streets.
Walk sign is on to cross East 52nd Street.
That's foot traffic. Pedestrian deaths actually increased by 7%. Engineer and historian Peter Norton says after public policy has prioritized cars for decades,
pedestrians are getting the message from Vision Zero that, hey, you know, we have a place in the street too. And that is going to be a dangerous mix for a while.
The city isn't done with the plan, according to New York City Traffic Commissioner Polly Trottenberg.
We've mapped out for all the streets in the city where we see the most crashes, and those are the places where we really prioritize our interventions.
That means more pedestrian islands and bike lanes. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Have you ever wondered, and come on, I know you have, where your credit card number goes when a big company like Target or Yahoo gets hacked? Chances are it winds up on something called the dark web, which explains how, a couple of weeks ago, I found myself in this very studio waiting for my guided tour of that very same dark web. Okay, so go. So here I am sitting in front of a not regular Marketplace laptop, but clearly some special thing that the IT guys have said, yes, you can mess around on the dark web with this thing. So what do I do?
Right.
That right you heard there came from Stephen Cobb. He's a senior researcher at a cybersecurity company called ESET. And the reason, by the way, that I'm using a non-Marketplace-approved laptop is because you can't just Google yourself onto the dark web. And even if you could, most corporate firewalls, like, say, ours, wouldn't let you. So the first hurdle is to download a different kind of web browser.
So the Tor browser is a modified version of Firefox. It's widely used, though, by NGOs around the world who are trying to remain anonymous.
Right. And the reason I want to stay anonymous here is that, in theory, were I a bad guy, I would be going on the dark web to do nefarious things.
Yes. Just to be clear, if you were a serious bad guy, you would probably also be running over what we call a virtual private network,
right.
And you'd be running a really good piece of security software.
Yeah.
But basically, you would use the search engine, and you would search for dark markets.
So the search engine here is what? I mean, it's not like I'm using Google, right? Or am I? I don't even know.
You're using a search engine, a very legitimate search engine called DuckDuckGo.
Aha.
Lower down the screen there, you can see the little icon of the duck.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a search engine that's built with privacy in mind.
Gotcha.
We're still in legitimate territory
okay. Here.
I promise nothing bad will happen when you hit return okay. Here.
So here we are, search for dark markets. And just like on the regular web, up come a bunch of search results, one of which is basically a dark markets user guide.
Top 43 markets there.
Top 43
dark
famous
web
markets,
market
daily
list.
Updates. Yes. All right. I scroll down to one that Stephen Cobb has used before. It's called Dream Market.
Yeah, go for the URL there.
URL right there, okay. He gives me a username and a password. Oh, look, they've even got a little forgot password thing here. There is one of those little CAPTCHA tests, too. A bunch of squiggly letters and numbers you have to read to prove you're not a robot. Do we think that's a G? I'm going to guess that's a G. I was wrong. It was a 9, but we got in eventually. Oh, all right. Dream Market. Here I am. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you see?
Browse by category. Digital goods, drugs, drug paraphernalia, services, and other. Huh.
Right. So let's go for digital
goods. What am I shopping
goods?
For? Digital goods. Okay. 61,221 of those. All right. So you can filter.
Yeah. You can see we've got a variety of things here. There may be some nudity and profanity.
There may be. Wow. Western Australia driver's license scans. Quebec new driver's license pictures. Utility bills. Credit cards. All right. So what should I click on? Because there's, you know, there's a lot of stuff here.
In the search text.
Yeah.
Type the word dumps, D-U-M-P-S.
Ooh.
Dumps are the way that stolen credit cards are
packaged
for resale.
All right. And I'm applying filter here?
Go for it.
Okay.
What we're looking at is your ability to buy stolen credit card data.
Yeah, sure.
So
look at this.
Fresh dumps. The way that these are sold is sometimes as random groups. Other times they're categorized down to zip code or state. Hmm.
I've got a pop-up screen here, right? And it says credit dumps, random bins, top quality. Gives you the vendor name, ships to worldwide, ships from worldwide. Do I click on view offer?
View the offer.
I should say, by the way, here that the thumbnail, the picture here is a stack of $100 bills for whatever that's worth.
There's a product description, and you'll see assurances, you know, all cards checked live right before sending, no refunds, no replacements.
Wow.
So a bunch of disclaimers as we have on goods we purchase on Amazon about what it will and will not do.
But what's great is it says, the dumps are valid, but we can't guarantee you 100% the dumps are going to work. So, you know, it's a little bit caveat emptor here, if you will.
Indeed. Yeah. They're claiming these are quality dumps, though, with a high balance.
Yeah.
Let's click on the vendor name and yeah. see what people think of him or her, whatever yeah. entity this is. And then look at ratings.
Yeah, yeah, no. So there's a bunch of 5 stars, right? And the comments go like you'd maybe expect on Amazon. Good guy. He'll work with you. Everybody's human. Just talk to him about your issues. Perfect as always. This man is the truth. Always delivers. Wow. All right. Oh, here's one. Here's a 1-star rating. Is dead. Nothing going. Fake, fake, fake. Shocking. Shocking.
So what we're seeing is really an experience like any other online market.
It kind of is. It's kind of like regular online shopping, except you're shopping for stolen personal information or credit cards or what have you. It's kind of bizarre.
Absolutely.
So I'm just trying to I'm looking at the pricing here. So 0.006 Bitcoin at $3,500 to a Bitcoin is I can't even do the math in my head, but it's not a whole lot of money.
Right. One of the things that we've seen is a steady downward pressure on pricing because the supply keeps increasing.
Yeah.
And it is a thoroughly market-based system. It's very sensitive to pricing. If there's a large credit card breach, for example, 5 years ago, we had the announcement of the Target breach.
Yeah, yeah.
All of those stolen credit cards, millions of them, tens of millions of them, went onto the dark market. And it did produce a drop in the price per card for a period of time.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Then over time, the freshness of the cards declines. And so you'll often see special offers on older cards, you know, month, 2 months on after a breach. It's a great study in market pricing.
It's insane. It's really an industry, right? I mean, there's a business model. There are many business models here, right? But certainly it works, and it's an active and viable marketplace.
Absolutely. It's very much a multi-level crime. So there are people who build the markets. There are other people who go out and they steal the information that is sold there. They create the malicious code that is sold there.
Oh,
or
yeah,
in the case of other illegal goods like drugs, they get the drugs somehow.
So they are actually companies, right? I mean, it's just you saying that there are people who create the code. Of course, there's some computer programmer out there who works for, I'm just going to pick one of these, you know, seller IDs here, Bitcoin Frauder, right? And so Bitcoin Frauder employs some coder to write the ransomware code that he can then turn around and sell on the dark web.
Yes.
It's a jobs machine.
Yeah, you're correct. That's absolutely right.
Yeah, and then working up a level, the platform itself, Dream Market, or whichever one of these dark websites you go to, that too is an enterprise. There are people there who hire coders and do, I don't know if quality assurance is a thing in crime, but one imagines that they do some kind of quality assurance on the products that get listed so you don't get out of business through a bad reputation, all of that stuff.
And in fact, there's a whole advertising side to it as well. So if you ever want to pursue this line of inquiry of employment, that's a very colorful part of the market because banner ads for credit card theft tend to be quite extreme.
Man. All right, Stephen, I got to go.
Well, sir.
Thanks very much for this. I appreciate it.
Yes, just be sure to wipe your computer after we're done.
I should tell you that the IT guy is standing right here about to take it out of my hot little hand.
Thanks, Guy. That was great.
There is a whole lot on the dark web we can't show you on a family-friendly homepage like ours, but we do have some screenshots, including some of those banner ads that Stephen was talking about. It's all at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which comes to us from Congressman Ralph Norman, Republican of South Carolina, via the 27th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. That, in case you don't remember, is the one that says, and here I quote, "No law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened." So, no congressional pay increases or cuts until there's been a congressional election. Congressman Norman, however, has proposed an amendment that would qualify that restriction. It would be number 28, by the way, were it ever to see the light of day, which it probably won't. Quote, "A representative or senator may not receive compensation with respect to any period during which a government shutdown is in effect." End of quote. I mean, it sounds fair, right? And I should point out here that Senator Mitch McConnell, leader of Republicans in the Senate, said today the shutdown could go weeks. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 18 today, less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ added 30, that's 0.4%. S&P 500 found 3 points, 0.1%. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostet, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.